We play the hits that sound more like everyone else than anyone else. This is the Religious Studies Project.
I actually got one of your references there, man. That's from Queens of the Stone Age album, isn't it?
Yeah. Songs for the deaf. You can't even hear it.
Chris, I need a saga. What's this week's saga?
This week's saga is Tommy Coleman speaking. I was going to say speaking with Walter Koenig, but Walter Koenig, of course, played Pavel Chekhov in the original series of Star Trek. So he's speaking with Harold Koenig on religion, spirituality, and health. And we
don't you kind of wish it was Walter Koenig?
I think that would be absolutely fantastic.
We'd get a lot of hits.
Tommy, if you could maybe try and arrange more interviews with Star Trek celebrities, that would maybe help our ratings a little bit. But I'm sure Harold will be just as good, if not better, on this topic at least.
And the topic is? Have we mentioned that?
Yes. So, when I'm saying it, read in scare quotes for every word. Religion, spirituality, and health. The most important scare quote being around the word "and" there.
Tommy? Harold?
I'm here at the Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health at Duke University with the director of the center, Dr. Harold Koenig. Dr. Koenig, what is the field of religion, spirituality, and health?
Well, the field of religion, spirituality, and health involves research that looks at the relationship between people's religious beliefs and practices and their health. And so it's the study of those relationships and the objective scientific examination of how religious beliefs and practices influence people's mental, physical, social health. So that's the research part of it. Then there is, of course, an application part, which involves applying that in clinical practice, or even at the societal level, in terms of policy, decision-making, those kinds of things. Applications at the bedside would involve doing a spiritual history, identifying spiritual needs of patients, and then addressing those spiritual needs. It also involves an educational piece, which helps to involve interpreting their findings from the research, and then also taking those findings and seeing how they might apply in clinical settings that might inform clinical interventions then to address spiritual needs or affect health outcomes in some way. So that is kind of the field. The field involves research, education, and application at a clinical and a societal level.
What precisely is the extent of the relationship? Are we just talking about people who are religious don't come down with the cold as much? What exactly is the range of the link here between possible health issues?
Well, it may be that people who are more religious don't quite as often come down with the cold, except that they are more likely to associate with others, which would increase their risk of developing a cold. So those are the kinds of things that a researcher would take into account when looking at the relationship. They would see whether or not religious people are more or less vulnerable to various health outcomes, and also depending upon their current situation. Do they have cancer? Are they dying? Are they stressed out because of a divorce or something of that nature? Are they getting older? Are they young, dealing with issues of relationship, etc.? Taking all of those things into account, does a religious involvement influence that more so than by chance alone, or more so than by other things that might influence those various aspects of health of the person? So we're talking about looking at significant relationships, identifying statistically significant and clinically significant relationships between religious involvement and a wide range of different mental, social, and physical health outcomes. Mental outcomes might be depression, anxiety, coping ability, quality of life, social outcomes might be social support, social interactions, a sense of satisfaction with support. It might involve marital satisfaction, marital durability. It might involve things such as delinquency or crime, social capital. Those are all kinds of social outcomes that religious involvement might influence. It could be, and then physical health outcomes that might be heart disease. It could be vulnerability to cancer. It could be outcome of cancer, prognosis. It could be blood pressure, could be stroke, it could be immune function, endocrine function, stress hormone levels. It could range to also things like self-rated health, functional disability, physical functioning, these kinds of health, mortality, etc.
So this is extremely wide.
Very wide, you know, in terms of what you're looking at in terms of health, yes.
And as I understand, the majority of these associations or relationships are positive. People who are more religious and spiritual do have better health in general on almost everything you've...
That is correct. The majority of studies find that those who are more religious, everything else being equal, that they have better mental, social, and physical health outcomes in general. Of course, things are never equal, and things are always changing. Mm-hmm. So that makes it challenging to find relationships between religious involvement and these outcomes, because these outcomes are changing. Mental health is changing. Social, physical health of people are changing. And their religious and spiritual beliefs are changing as well as people grow and mature and develop. So we're trying to, these are two things that are changing, and we're trying to see how they are related, which is challenging, very challenging.
Are there perhaps any differences among religions or even denominations in terms of health? Differences, if I could just pick a religion, if you will, that would give me the best health, is there such a thing that we found? What are the differences between some of the, has there been any work done on some of the differences? Do they matter?
Do they matter? The content of faith does matter to some degree. It does matter. Now, you know, there is a whole lot of studies that have compared different religions. But it does seem as though that devoutness, the devoutness of a person to their religious faith, is what seems to be the main factor. To what extent has that person's religious faith become an important part of their life that informs their life and their decisions? That is what really matters.
Sincerity.
To be honest with you. Yes.
Sincerity of belief as opposed
sincerity
to just nominal
belief.
Identification of...
Plus a little bit the content of belief. Okay? So there is some issue of the content, but it's more the sincerity of the belief, I think, that is really more influential. I mean, this is, I'm doing a major review of health and well-being in Islamic societies. A major review. That's, in fact, 90% of my time for the last year has been spent on this. And I just finished the mental health review for all the research in mental health Islamic countries worldwide, and very similar to relationships as in Christianity, if not a little stronger, actually, maybe a little stronger, but very similar in terms of the findings. A lot more in Muslim countries. Only about 1-2% of the research worldwide on this topic comes from Muslim countries. But of the research of those 1-2%, you look at the studies, you find that they're pretty impressive. You know, you don't want to be a non-Muslim, you don't want to be a Muslim with a weak religious faith in a Muslim country. Those people don't do well. I mean, that's just very clear. Now, whether it's the chicken or the egg, You know, whether if you have a bad life, then you turn away from your faith, and then that reflects in your health. You know, there's probably both. There are probably both going on there to some degree, because it's hard to know, you know, what is. But, yeah, it's fascinating. I think that the interreligious dialogue, but, you know, it's really the devout people. It's really those who are devout that really matters. The health of a devout Muslim, the health of a devout Christian is probably going to be pretty similar.
Understand.
Yeah.
When we're comparing things, religion, spirituality, and health, how are we really saying much when we're comparing religion to something that is non-religion? Kind of like comparing if I had a dollar to not having a dollar. And I bring this up because in some of your books you've talked about secular sources for comparisons at almost every level of the religion, spirituality, health field is a way, you know, to really have comparison there, something equivalent where we can see what is at work as opposed to just religion and not religion.
Yeah, it's not quite been done, but there have been studies out of Israel looking at religious kibbutz versus secular kibbutz.
What would that allow us, if the field were to find some of these secular sources that you've mentioned, what would that allow us to do? Would that be much more powerful when we're talking about these...
I think it would assist. There's no question that would help to have a kind of a model where you have other things are equal, you know, and the only element that's different is the religious element. Mm. Yes, I think that would be helpful. You know, we actually have someone here that's interested in atheism in the workshop, setting that as a religion in itself. Well, although, you know, that's more parallels it's more religious, I think, in terms of devoutness and commitment, you know. But it's a better comparison, just secular, I think, with religious. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, we are involved in a randomized clinical trial right now that is doing exactly that. Depressed patients are getting the best of secular cognitive behavioral therapy versus religious cognitive behavioral therapy, and we're seeing if that makes any difference. So that would be an example.
That would be very interesting to hear when it comes out. Yeah. When do you expect that to end? Or?
We've recruited everybody. Most have gone through the therapy now. It's probably be another year before it comes out in the journals.
Okay.
Yeah, we have to write it up, analyze the data, write it up, and then get it published. So it'll probably be at least a year, probably next fall or winter, fall of 2014.
Mentioned there are a lot of strengths in the relationship between religion, spirituality, and health. What are perhaps some maybe a weakness or something that the field needs to improve? As I understand, 80 to 90% of the studies done are all cross-sectional correlational.
Yeah.
See many positive benefits. What are some things that might need to be improved in terms of
Yes, we've got plenty of cross-sectional studies. We need prospective studies where people are followed over time and health outcomes, changes in health outcomes examined. We need clinical trials that looks at religious interventions to see if the specific religious intervention, the religious aspect, has an effect on changing the outcome. We need more studies in medical illnesses and in looking at disease outcomes and disease course. Of course, all of these are very challenging to go at that level because there's no money to support research like this. So how does one do it? And that becomes the challenge. How do you do it? It can be done, but you have to piggyback religious variables onto existing clinical trials or existing studies, prospective studies. It's a low-cost way of just adding 4 or 5 religious questions to a baseline assessment, and then, you know, just carrying out the study and then analyzing that data and then publishing it. So analyzing the data and publishing it then becomes something that people need to be trained on how to analyze the data and then to publish the research, as well as to connect with and work with researchers in getting those 5 questions into the baseline interview. And that's why this workshop is important. That's what we train people to do here.
You, when you were mentioning, you know, that you have a lot of trouble getting funding in this area, and I can imagine that, you know, a lot of the work some academics do is just, you can read it and it's, you know, you have a little more knowledge. What is the impact beyond just knowing that there's a link that religion, spirituality, and health can provide on a global level?
Well, there are many potential. First of all, societies are secularizing now. So what are the consequences of the secularizing of societies? You know, what will happen in Saudi Arabia as it becomes more secular? What will happen with disease rates of alcoholism, drug use, marital relationships, etc., as religion becomes less of an influence in society? I mean, they're very practical in terms of economics, in terms of medical care, in terms of survival and flourishing of countries in a competitive environment. So major, major, on the individual level, of course, there are many people who are religious, for whose religious beliefs they have spiritual needs as a result of those beliefs that emerge during healthcare situations, and those needs a lot of times are avoided or neglected or, you know, and the consequence we already know from a series of studies at Harvard looking at end-of-life care, that creates lots of needless use of healthcare services that costs thousands and thousands of dollars to the hospital and the healthcare system. So we're talking about very practical consequences of either addressing issues or not addressing issues, and then in terms of disease prevention across the country. You know, there are implications for that as well, and planning for health services. So lots of this is really has implications, practical implications, across the board, at the society level, at the healthcare level, and at the individual level, in terms of children getting their education as opposed to getting pregnant during school, during high school, and getting on drugs and alcohol, and not finishing their education, not having health insurance later on. I mean, and religion preventing that, preventing smoking, preventing alcoholism, lots of different issues, relationships, marital relationships, family durability in terms of children being raised, in terms of future crime, delinquency. I mean, you can just go on and on and on.
With regards to religion and spirituality, what is the framework you use to define that? What's your working, your operational definition when we're talking about religion or spirituality? Is it always in reference to the transcendent with a capital T, or?
Yes. The answer is yes. It's always in reference to the transcendent with a capital T, otherwise call it something else. Very simple. We can do psychosocial research all we want, behavioral research, or we're doing it. You know, just keep calling it that. Don't call it spiritual or religious, because that is a sign to the transcendent with the capital T.
You certainly won't get an argument out of me from that.
Right, right. No, I have plenty of people argue that, but that's okay.
But has there been any research done on the relationship religion, spirituality, health, and some new religious movements? Is there any?
Not much, because people, a little bit. There's a little bit in psychiatry. That was actually in the 1990s and 2000s, that was done by a guy up at Albert Einstein, a psychiatrist up there. I'm blanking out on his name right now. He's a well-known psychiatrist. He looked at cults. He did a lot of work with cults. I'm just blanking out on his name right now. But various cults in the New York area and otherwise, looking at those areas. Now, in terms of New Age, not a lot of research in New Age, although there are some instruments that have been developed to study New Age spirituality. There are instruments that could be done, but not a lot of research. I haven't seen a lot of that really published. Again, those kinds of people engaged in those, they don't have the skills and the training to do research. Mm-hmm. They don't have the resources. You know, you have to have some real solid resources. And a lot of the new religious movements or cult movements, they don't attract mainstream people who end up with education. and skill to be able to conduct research.
Especially if it's hard enough conducting research on large-scale operations and religion, spirituality, and health, it's going to be much harder on a very small subsegment of the population.
And that is an issue, too. Your samples, how are you going to get samples large enough to be able to generalize? That becomes an issue. How do you get to those people also? Because they tend to be, you know, they push away to general society because, again, part of the new religious movements, they emerge by, first of all, separating themselves from the society in general. How they emerge. So there's a pattern that makes them inaccessible to study, objective study. And some of them don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be studied. So there are reasons why we don't have a lot of information on that. But we've got plenty to study in mainstream religion. We know very little about just because of the range within each mainstream religion. We have Christians who don't even believe in God, don't believe Jesus, you know, ranging to, you know, fundamentalists. I mean, the same within Judaism and Islam and Buddhism. You know, Buddhists, 40% of American Buddhists are certain that God exists. And in fact, Buddhism is not supposed to believe in divinity. So it's just a tremendous range. So studying that range itself is, we got our hands full, given the limited funding and the few people who are researchers in this area with the skills.
I know we have a limited time today, so I was hoping in closing if could kind of bring us back 50 years ago. Was there a field of religion, spirituality, and health, and where is it going from this point onward? So how did come to be, and where is it going?
It was very small 50 years ago, and there were a few people. David Moberg was one of them, and then there were, of course, William James earlier, and several. And of course, pastoral care has gone back to the 20s, etc. So all of that has been, but research, that's fairly new. That is fairly new, really. The studies really weren't published until the '60s, and very little then the '70s, '80s, '90s. It's really started to expand. 2000 exploded in the last 10 years, the last 5 years have been enormous. So it's been really growing. And what is the future? I think just getting more specific and learning more about the details of each religion. I think the future should focus on is learning about the fundamental teachings of each religious group and applying those and seeing how that influences health. So not the general spirituality and that's going to be of the past. It was a blip. I think it's going, because there's no substance to it. It's the religions that have lasted for thousands of years that have substance. That's what affects health. And so I think understanding that better and understanding how it affects, I think we have only seen just the scratch, the tip of the iceberg here. Just the very tip. Because I think religion is fundamental to health. Mm-hmm. All health of any kind. Societal health, physical, individual, communal, mental, physical, everything is influenced in ways we have just starting to scratch the surface in terms of health, well-being, and flourishing of society. So, we have 2 minutes.
If the listeners to the Religious Studies Project podcast are interested in finding more about find out more about religion, spirituality, and health, both online and perhaps in person, how to conduct research in an area that, as I understand from your books, is just wide open. There's lots to be done, and yes, not a lot of people doing it.
Exactly.
Where can they go? How can people get involved in this field?
Our website. Go to the Duke Center for Spirituality and Health website. Because that is a portal into this world. We have an e-newsletter that goes out every month that reviews the latest research, the latest news, the latest conferences, the latest research grants. It will keep you informed. The website is an archive of videos, of resources in terms of articles, journals, research that's been done. It really is even national news. We have national news programs from 1995, ABC, CBS, all of these on the website. You can watch these. So it really is a portal for learning about this area. And at any level, really, it's designed for people who are very experienced and advanced in research and are academics at Harvard and Hopkins and Stanford, all the way down to Joe Blow and Sally, from the community that's kind of interested in this. So it's the widest range possible. But that website, that's it.
Absolutely. I want to thank Dr. Koenig, who's the director, again, from the Center for Spirituality, Theology, and Health here at Duke University, for speaking with us today. Thank you, Dr. Koenig.
Thank you very much, Tommy.
Another interesting interview.
It was an interesting interview, and I... it's one of those things that I appreciate research being done into this area, and I know that when you do that kind of research, it involves a certain form of reductionism. But at the same time, it's my just like no, don't reduce religion to a tick box thing comes in.
Well, this is Tommy and I actually had a conversation about this the other day on Facebook about the propensity of. Psychology to use categories rather, without really qualifying them too much, and to use folk categories without sort of too much reflection. I think that's maybe a fault, but it's also just it's a difference.
Well, yeah, and when you're out there trying to do large scale quantitative research, you've got to have
exactly
distinct categories.
It's just, I think it's the reproduction of emic terminology from surveys in the conclusions in etic writing. I sometimes have a bit of a problem with. I've seen the same stuff in psychology writing about conspiracy theories, for instance, where they'll come to conclusions like, we've found that people who subscribe to conspiracy theories are more likely to reject other forms of authority, whereas any sensible discursive historiographical analysis of the term would have shown you that that's the origin of the term. That's what it's always meant. It means when you disagree with the account from the authorities. So you're seeing their conclusion is essentially, they've gone through a large amount of statistical work to come to the same conclusion that they could have come to without doing that. If they'd have just actually thought about the terms they're using rather than reproducing them. However, that be said, if I can continue, Chris, if that's all right.
Yes, please do.
I think the relationship between health and I'm doing quotes again, spiritual narratives in contemporary religiosity is under-researched and under-theorized.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of circumstantial evidence and a few beginnings of studies. Hopefully somebody can email us and tell us a bit more about this if they know of more data, but this sort of seekership journey starting with ill health in one form or another and leading into alternative therapies, which leads into alternative spiritualities.
Yeah. And I indeed had a very interesting conversation with our colleague Richard Saville Smith yesterday. He's towards the end of his PhD, he's looking at sort of the connection between medical definitions of madness and I guess you could say what Weber would have called charisma, religious charisma.
A spiritual, the varieties of spiritual experience kind of model.
Just discussing whether things which are defined as medically not normal could actually be, more conducive to what are commonly described as religious experiences. So there's a lot of research that could be done there, and as has been highlighted in Tommy's interview, so thanks
indeed. So
very
much
for that.
And interesting to see that from the psychology angle, which it's what Tommy does. It's what he brings to the project.
Exactly. And it's what we don't bring to it, which is exactly why we got Tommy on board. Next week, we've got another new thing for you. we had a round table for you last week that came out on the sort of academic credibility that we'd recorded. This week, I would suggest that this roundtable is a bit more academically credible than our podcast on academic credibility. It's one that Dave McConaughey recorded at the AAR, at the AAR's That Camp. Do you want to say a bit about what That Camp is?
I'm trying to remember what that is. It's the Humanities and Technology Camp, is it?
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
I will just confirm. Yes.
Because we don't normally abbreviate the, but I think in this case That Camp made more sense than Hat Camp. But in this case, you know, Dave has his interviewer hat on and he's chairing a discussion amongst the organisers of That Camp at AAR, talking about how we as scholars of religion can use technology, particularly I think social media, digital technology, rather than, you know, large mecha robots or anything like that,
but
in our teaching and dissemination of our work. Obviously something that the Religious Studies Project are passionately interested in.
Yeah. And we'll probably say a bit more about it in the intro next week, but Dave is he's very up on this sort of thing. His blog, which is, I can't remember the URL, but it's called A Lively Experiment, so if you just pop that into Google, he blogs quite regularly on...
We share it quite often on the Facebook page. This is the first of two recordings that he did for us at AAR. He's a good friend of the project, so we're happy to bring this.
Absolutely. As ever, remember that we're sponsored by the BASR, who are fantastic. You can see their website at bsr.ac.uk. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Google+. I don't think we've got onto any other networks yet, but do check us out there. And don't forget about the Amazon links, .com.ca and .uk. You're doing well, folks. Just anytime you're purchasing through Amazon, if you click through from our site, we earn not insignificant amounts of money from that, and it really does help. That's my spiel over, David.
Okay, well, there's one thing that Clone Radio still needs to say.
Thanks for listening.